Robert A.G. Monks is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about George Orwell, who you may remember wrote 1984. And a lot of what 1984 is about, Mr. Monks, is about this business of language. And then you carry forth quite beautifully with this, I guess you'd call it a neologism, corpocracy, as compared to democracy, demos being the people, and corp being corporation. This fusion, if you will, of democracy and its evil twin. I love it that you call it its evil twin, because there are moral and ethical as well as economic and political issues involved when you talk about corpocracy, right?
Indeed, there are. And to linger on the language for a minute,
please.
One of the things that's most difficult is that otherwise very intelligent people sit around and have discussions about how the political model really explains corporate power. And they borrow the vocabulary from the political model. So shareholders elect directors. Shareholders have never elected directors in the history of man. Directors are picked by the incumbents, and a slate is prepared with just the number of vacancies that there are ready to be elected that year. And the person who receives the slate has about four choices. He can write in a new name if he wants to. He can throw it away. He can vote for all or any of them. But whatever happens, the people on the slate are going to get elected. Well, that's not an election.
Well, the premise is that shareholders are as if they were citizens.
Yeah.
The board of directors is as if it were the
legislature.
The CEO is as if he were the chief executive or the president, and the bylaws are as if they were the Constitution. Bylaws and charter. Well, I've never seen it formulated as clearly as you did in Corpocracy in that way. And it belies really important truths.
Well, what either somebody is very smart and is trying to use the legitimacy of our political vocabulary for power, or it just happened.
Which could also be the case. Well, then you talk about shareholder democracy.
Or it could be some judicious mixture of the two.
The idea of shareholder democracy, which is one that you champion. And I guess it's important to say you champion capitalism as a really important way to generate common good. So this is not a bashing of capitalism model of which you speak. When you talk about shareholder democracy within a capitalist system, that means something.
The important message about corporations is that they really are the best device that any society has ever concocted to create wealth. And then the real problem comes on the implications of gathering wealth, and to include in the language by which you account for that the various external impacts on society.
Externalities.
Externalities, as the economists would have it. And the difficulty is that there's a great resistance to trying to include those. So in effect, externalities are thrust onto the public. And the corporation doesn't have to be an evil creature. But the way in which the corporation now functions with its externalizing, it makes of every customer and every shareholder an enabler. Because when you buy something from a company that externalizes liabilities, you are making it possible for that company to be profitable and thereby enabling those activities which are contrary to the best interests of each of us and a society.
And wealth doesn't mean the CEO. When you say the generation of wealth, it has to do with the whole society, not just a handful of self-selected individuals.
The great dream for America is that through the pension systems, through the mutual funds, that the average American can get access to the wealth generation capability of large corporations. And it's quite simple, really. Over 200 years, the rate of return after inflation for debt securities is 2%, and the rate of growth for equity securities is 6%. And after 10 years, you're talking about a great, great difference. And it isn't just individuals who get this. It is, for example, when a city makes a commitment to its employees to pay them in a pension. Well, if they can only put invested money to work at 2%, it's going to be very, very difficult. They're going to have to raise taxes a great deal to be able to pay a meaningful pension. Whereas if they're able to invest this in common stocks, the 6% traditional rate of return makes it possible for society to take a much wider view. So it's wealth spread broadly.
I want to go back to the language, sort of, and specifically the science of economics.
The so-called science.
You point out something that I think most people don't know, and I forget a lot, which is that the Nobel Prize in economics, which we hear a great deal, and policies are endorsed because an economist who has won the Nobel Prize endorses this policy or this approach, whatever. And it isn't so. There is no effective Nobel Prize and no legitimate, right, depending on who you talk to, Nobel Prize. But the whole notion of the role of economics in providing the substrate for this corporocracy, I think, is really important, and is not, I think most of us don't know about it, have not experienced or understood how this works.
Well, make sure that we say what the Bank of Sweden Prize is in memory of Nobel, that it's not the Nobel Prize, it's the Bank of Sweden Prize.
Right. Now, I have a friend, actually, who at the same time the Bank of Sweden offered the prize for economics, he offered one for environmentalism.
Oh, my.
And they turned him down.
Really?
His name is Jakob von Uxeld, and he runs a thing called the World Future Council. Mm-hmm. And he's a Swede, and there were people at work who thought that the patina, as it were, of the Nobel name would enhance the relative importance of economics, and that's really been wrong. It really economics generates a number of worthwhile ideas, but they're not scientific, and they certainly don't deserve to be the sole discourse of public policy.
As they are now.
Yes. Stop and think for a minute about the last time somebody said to you as a governmental matter that they weren't going to do something because it was wrong. People will say they're not going to do it because it isn't cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about changing schools to make them work in a more business-like way. People talk about cost effectiveness of the delivery of medicine.
Efficiency, cost-benefit analysis.
Well, the cost-benefit analysis. Now, you do a nice job of putting that in context, in a historical context, and how that has diminished our understanding of economics, specifically, but more generally, our understanding of living in a community.
And what matters in life.
That's the thing, is that as economics has about it a rather beguiling characteristic, and that is that if you just suspend disbelief for a while and assume that you can make a quantity or a number out of values, then you can put these into formulae and you can run them into computers and have high-speed printers, and out comes this enormous amount of material that must contain a good answer. Well, wrong, unfortunately. It contains a great deal of material. But the problem is that most important questions, indeed, from my way of thinking, all important questions, are not susceptible of being quantified.
Questions like?
Like, is it the right thing to do? Or, on balance, is it fair? Is it fair in our society to have the allocation of wealth that we have now?
And even more fundamentally, I mean, economics touches people in various very specifically, it used to be political economics, mm-hmm. and then it got narrowed down, became a science, and then we lost the political piece. But finance would seem to lend itself to that, more technical, more numerical, and yet we've just gone through an experience with subprime loans, and I came across somebody with I think it was a hedge fund, who had said, you know, our models said that the probability of this happening was 10 to the minus 29th or something, which is a very small number. That is to say, it's essentially zero, that this could not happen, and yet it happened. Mm-hmm. And I say that because even in a narrower, more specific, numerically based discipline, finance, it is still not a science. There are a lot of assumptions, there are a lot of wishing and hoping, politics gets involved in it. So it's not surprising that something that is more general economics would not be reducible to numbers.
I'm going to interrupt so I don't have to do it again. It's also worth saying Adam Smith was a moral philosopher and moral philosophy was what he pursued as well as economics. This is Robert A.G. Monks with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. We'll all be back shortly. Please do stay with us.